called the causal patch measure. But the causal patch, and I think this is one of its main arguments in its favor, is not something that was invented to solve the measure problem. So the causal patch is sort of the stone, this is a stone, that kills currently up to three birds. Bird one, two, bird three. Okay. The first time the stone was thrown was to deal with the Xeroxing paradox that arises in the formation and evaporation of a black hole. That's the famous old story that if you have a quantum state here of some star that collapses and you believe that that state is returned in the Hawking radiation, then you can draw a time slice that contains two copies of this quantum state. You start it with one that violates the linearity of quantum mechanics. But as was pointed out by Lenny Susskind, this problem is one that I have if I insist on a global description of this space-time, but it goes away if I ask whether anybody can actually see this duplication happening, and the answer is no. If I'm inside the black hole, I can see this copy, and this one I can't see because of causality, and conversely, if I'm outside the black hole, I can see what's outside the black hole and not the copy inside. I can see the Hawking radiation. So there have to be consistent descriptions, of course, for any observer. But apparently, if we insist on something more than that, if we insist on a global description that nobody can verify, we run into problems. And it seems very difficult to see how a restriction like this could be confined to this narrow context. Once we are forced to give up this global viewpoint, then it seems like, well, that's the way it's going to be. And so it seemed natural to see whether this restriction helps us with the situation that led to the measure problem, which is the multiverse. So this is a schematic picture of the multiverse. Here are all these bubbles forming in different places. Bubbles within bubbles, of course. Each one of them is an infinite open universe, and there are infinitely many of each type of bubble that will form. And so you don't know how to compute relative probabilities. This has been discussed yesterday. You want to say something like this, perhaps, but both of these numbers of occurrences of events of type A and B diverge in this space-time, and so you don't know how to compute this probability. Well, perhaps if we adopt this lesson that we learned in the context of black holes, these numbers become finite, and that turns out to be the case. The next question is then whether they give you probabilities that don't conflict with observation. So that would be the application to the measure problem. And there's another problem that Lenny Susskind will talk about, I think, in a couple days, that I won't talk about at all. But I think that thinking of the universe in terms of a causal patch also helps us understand how to apply quantum mechanics to the entire universe, in the sense that the entire universe is actually not this thing, but just that thing, and that helps with understanding things like decoherence. Okay. So I'm going to talk about the application of the causal patch to this particular problem. Again, I think it's very natural. It's something that we have to do anyway. We might as well get some more mileage out of it. And what I find amazing is that what I would consider a very well-motivated, theoretically motivated proposal, at least as far as any of the motivations for any of these proposals go, this one is, I think, pretty well-motivated, that it also does extremely well phenomenologically. It's not perfect, and I'll get to some problems at the end, but I think that the success has certainly exceeded expectations. So let me get started with some claims. I mean, there are many things that have been worked out, but I want to focus on a particular set of results that appeared recently in papers with Ben Freifogel, Stefan Leichenauer, both of whom are in the audience, and Vladimir Rosenhaus, who was supposed to be here but unfortunately fell ill, and also similar results previously appeared in papers with Ronnie Harnick. So the claim is the following. One thing that the causal patch does, which at least to me wasn't obvious for several years, even though we studied it pretty intensely, is that it allows us to understand a number of predictions for interesting physical quantities, or postdictions in many cases, such as the cosmological constant or the spatial curvature scale, in a way that is completely general and does not rely on any specific anthropic assumptions at all, but turns out to be determined mainly by the geometric aspects of this measure, okay, by what is actually being cut out of the space-time. So remember that generally the rule with all the measures that I would say fall into this class of geometric cutoffs is, well, you separate the universe into a piece that you throw away, which is infinite, and a piece that you keep, which had better be finite, and you compute this ratio in that finite piece. With some approaches, you later take some limit. With this one, you don't. And this finite piece, well, it's basically the causal horizon of some point on the future boundary. How that point is sampled or determined is, I think, to some extent still an open problem. There are different ways that we've been doing that, and in most cases the results don't depend very sensitively on how you do that. One way of doing it is to pick some initial surface down here and to average over causal patches that are generated by different orthogonal world lines. Another way is to put a metric on the future boundary and then sprinkle it uniformly with such endpoints and then average over those causal diamonds or causal patches. For the results that I'm going to talk about today, it doesn't matter in the slightest what I do. So now let me state the claim. Okay. Okay. So my claim is that the causal patch predicts that the time scale of the cosmological constant, when that starts dominating, the time scale when curvature starts dominating, and the time scale when observers live are correlated to each other. They're not very different from each other. And this you should really think as a statement about the logs of these scales. I'm not going to be able to predict any of these to better accuracy than estimating the size, the, you know, the fact that the logs should not be, you know, they should coincide. This is a type of result that's similar in nature to the kind of correlation that, say, Weinberg's argument gave us a long time ago, the argument that T lambda should have something to do with T galaxy, a priori two completely unrelated timescales that were correlated by his argument. And that's fine. It's a highly non-trivial statement to make. But there's an additional thing which I would say at least for the first time the causal patch has opened a door to thinking about. And that allows us to perhaps continue this set of equalities, which is, you know, you can keep going, you can correlate all sorts of scales to each other, you can try to understand why there are so many coincidences, say, in the cosmology that we observe. There's so many things that happen on a giga-year time scale that a priori have nothing to do with each other, for example. And that's great. It's wonderful to understand that. But at the end of the day, you would like to understand at some point where does that one large number come from that you need to get all the others? Let's say you think of the cosmological constant as being, you know, the ultimate hierarchy. You know, you can try to relate lots of other crazy numbers to that one, but where did that come from? Why a number like 10 to the minus 123? Okay. And the speculation that I want to include in this talk, and that is at least suggested by the kind of analysis that I'll present, is that that number, that these crazy numbers are related to the number of metastable vacua in the string landscape. So let me call n that number. And I'll have to slightly qualify what I mean by this n later in the talk, but that's the basic idea. So in a way, the hope is that in the end, even though, you know, what used to perhaps, you know, the hope used to be perhaps in string theory that we'll get a unique prediction for things like the electron mass and so on, I think we now realize, or at least many of us believe, that that's not going to happen. The predictions will be statistical. That's not necessarily a bad thing if you understand the theory well. Statistical predictions can be very sharp. But at the end of the day, you're still going to get the important numbers out, okay? And they're going to come from pure math. Right? If this sort of idea is right, that, you know, what determines this number of vacua is something like, you know, that it's the exponential of the number of non-trivial cycles in a Calabi-Yau manifold. So it's in a way rescuing a little bit of that old dream. I don't know if that would make David Gross any happier. I doubt it, but it's worth a try. So. So that's the claim, and now let me try to take you through the argument. And, oh, one more important caveat. I'm going to talk about half of the landscape, not all of it. Okay, I will restrict myself to vacuum with positive cosmological constant. Negative cosmological constant, all the formulas are different, and plus it doesn't work so well, and I'll come back to that at the very end of the talk. So I'll do this in two steps, okay? I'm trying to really make statements about three parameters: the time scale when the cosmological constant dominates, when curvature dominates, when the observers live, and correlate all of these to the number of vacua. I'm going to start by holding fixed to the observer. It's arbitrary. Later on, I'll let it scan. But I'll start by holding the observer fixed and thinking about a probability distribution over these two variables at fixed the observer. Okay, so this is the first step. Treat the observer as an arbitrary input parameter. So this is some time scale at which observers live. For us, this would be, you know, 10 giga years. And the goal is to compute the probability distribution over the other parameters. And now we need to break up this problem in some way. A useful way to break it up is to say, well, this probability distribution consists of two pieces. One has to do with the distribution of these quantities log Tc and log T lambda in the theory space, in the multiverse, or more, well, so in the landscape of string theory, or more precisely, the probability of this randomly chosen world line to enter a particular vacuum with values Tc and T lambda. So that also factors in cosmological dynamics and selection effects. However, the assumption here is that T lambda and Tc are determined by a lot of low energy physics, low energy compared to what determines the barriers between vacua, which is basically string scale stuff. And so they should not be correlated with the dynamics that determines this tunneling, you know, from one vacuum into another, because you don't really know what's going to happen at low energies long after you enter these vacua. And so I'm going to assume that this prior distribution is essentially the same that it would be if I just look at the distribution in the landscape, if I look at the actual distribution of all the vacua in theory space. Now, once my world line enters one of these vacua, what matters is, so here's a bubble, here's the causal patch. What matters is, so here are infinitely many observers, perhaps. If there are any observers in this particular vacuum, there'll be infinitely many. But what I count is how many there are inside the causal patch at this time T observer. Okay, yes? Sorry, why TC? Oh, yeah, I was going to say that a little bit later, but I might as well say it now. So the fantasy here is that GC is determined by inflation. So the idea is that the dominant mechanism for avoiding early curvature domination is inflation. And so then the actual TC is basically e to the number of e foldings. And so it depends on the slow roll potential in the particular vacuum. But again, I would expect that, you know, that slow roll potential is somewhere down here. It has nothing to do with the tunneling rate. And so it shouldn't be terribly highly correlated. It's possible to imagine situations where it is anyway, but so that is should be considered an assumption. I don't think it's a very strong one. So good. So what I'm actually trying to do is I'm trying to count the expected number of observers that are going to see these values. So that depends, first of all, on the probability that my world line is going to enter a vacuum that has these values, but then I have to multiply that by the number of observers that see them. Okay, so that's number of observers that see these values of TC and T lambda, and I, of course, insist that these observers happen at a time T observer, otherwise I'm not interested, because that is my, that's my input parameter. Okay. So now I have to tell you how I'm going to calculate all these things. The probability distribution over the cosmological constant is the easy part. That's the one Weinberg figured out. On very general grounds, one can argue that that should be essentially flat, at least for sufficiently small intervals around lambda equals zero, because zero is not a special place from the point of view of particle physics. And so you can just Taylor expand. And so since we're writing everything in terms of distributions over the log of all these variables, I have to put in a Jacobian. I get this distribution for the prior distribution over log T lambda. That's just the statement that it's 10 times more likely, if I put all the vacuum in a bag, it's 10 times more likely that I'll pull out one with 10 times larger cosmological constant. The next prior distribution is the distribution over the number of e-foldings of inflation, log TC. And I'm going to call this G and leave it unspecified. I'm not going to put in a particular value, though I'll tell you right now that I'm going to make the same assumptions that Ben and Matt and others have already mentioned, which is that this distribution drops off like a power law. It's harder to find more a vacuum with more e-foldings of inflation, but not exponentially harder. And that's all that's going to matter. It's not going to matter whether this number is 4 or 6 or whatever. So these are pretty, well, I think this isn't really an assumption. This is pretty solid argument for this. This is an assumption to some extent. I mean, we don't really understand the landscape well enough. But I think that if it was harder than this to find models of inflation, of slow roll inflation in the landscape, then we're doomed. Okay, so in a sense, that would make, you know, inflation so unlikely that it's about just as unlikely as having a flat universe by chance, which we know is not something that will help solve the flatness problem. So now I have to turn to this this quantity here, and that's of course the part that usually is called the anthropic factor or whatever. You have to put in how many observers there are in these vacua, and the nice thing is that that's going to get a lot less anthropic. The detailed anthropic bits matter surprisingly little. So I'm going to write this n observer as some number alpha times the mass of matter on inside the causal patch region. This matter mass at the time T observer, of course, is extremely easy to compute. If I know T observer, I know T lambda, I know TC, I can compute precisely how much mass there is in this region. It's completely straightforward. It's just geometry plus Einstein's equation. I just work out what the density is and multiply it by the volume. So that's easy to compute. This alpha is the number of observers per unit mass. Yes, Tom. I'm not insisting that it consists of pressureless dust, if that's what you mean. But I am insisting that it consists of something that redshifts faster than curvature. Okay, so that's strictly speaking another assumption. Again, I don't think a very strong one, but W had better be greater than minus a third. When I write down exact answers, they will apply to the case where it's pressureless dust. But the gist is the same, whether I replace this by radiation or something else. It's useful to break it up this way, okay, the number of observers, because this is fairly trivial to compute. And this alpha is where all the anthropic crap is hiding, right? That's where we need to know, you know, how many observers are there per unit mass in this universe. And it turns out that our ignorance about alpha bothers us only in places where the probability distribution is so strongly suppressed that we really don't care. Okay, and I'll explain how that comes about. But again, I want to emphasize here, I am not assuming that I'm dealing with vacua which are, say, the same as ours except for these three numbers. I'm not assuming that observers need carbon or galaxies or whatever it is. I'm not even assuming that those words make any sense in the vacua that I'm considering here. So there are three parameters I'm including explicitly, and the rest is just averaged over. So now what we need to do is actually compute this. And again, I'm going to start by not dealing with alpha because that's the fast progress that we can make immediately. Okay. So let me write down a metric. There are really two cases that I have to separate. One is the case where curvature dominates before the cosmological constant does. And one is where Tc is greater than T lambda, which actually means the curvature never dominates. In that case, you can think of Tc as the time when curvature would have dominated if we artificially set lambda equal to zero. But of course, if the cosmological constant starts kicking in before you get to see spatial curvature, then you'll never see it. That seems to be the case for us, unless we get lucky pretty soon. Okay. So let me start with the first case. So we have a metric in this universe that I just erased. Let's put it back here. So these are constant T slices. This is an open universe that follows from the bubble geometry, and the metric is of this form. Alan, how am I doing with time? 18. Okay. So this is a unit hyperboloid. That's a scale factor. By the way, it doesn't matter very much what happens after this vacuum decays into some other vacuum as long as it is long-lived on a time scale compared to T lambda. In other words, if it's reasonably metastable, the late time, you would think that what happens at late times determines how large the causal patch is in the vacuum that we're interested in, but if you do the calculation, it turns out that that's actually not true, up to super exponentially small corrections. So we don't have to worry about that. We're going to treat this as if this vacuum was never going to decay. So what we need to do is, I shouldn't have put this at the other end. As a function of time, right, what we want to know, so here are different times, we want to know how big is the causal patch in co-moving coordinates? What is chi cp as a function of time? Right. How far in this radial variable, how far out is this horizon? Of course, you determine that by integrating the path of the light rays up to the future boundary. So that's what you do. And then you get some expressions that I won't all write down because they're pretty boring. So there's some case distinction here. It depends on whether the time of interest, the time of interest, of course, is the observer time scale, so let's just put it in, is between the curvature and lambda domination, or before curvature domination, or after lambda domination. Okay, so there are various expressions that you can compute from this metric, where I'm obviously going to make use of the actual scale factor that solves this F or W universe first with matter domination. Matter domination, then curvature domination, then lambda domination. Okay, we know how to do this, so I'll spare you the algebra. Now, the next thing that I need to know is this is sort of the co-moving radius, hyperbolic radius, I guess, of the horizon, of the causal patch boundary. Now what I want to know is how much volume is there actually in here at the time t observer? What's this volume? Well, I need the hyperbolic volume, which I can approximate as this co-moving radius cubed, as long as I'm at less than one curvature radius, because then it's like being in flat space. That corresponds to the case where the observer time scale is greater than T lambda. Otherwise, it's essentially the same thing as the area. So it's e to the 2 chi causal patch, and that's the opposite case, which corresponds to T observer being before cosmological constant dominates. And then, of course, the mass inside the causal patch is just the co-moving volume times the scale factor cubed to get the physical volume times the energy density. Okay, and that turns out to simplify to the following expression. You just multiply the co-moving volume with the with TC. Okay, so now we can go back to this formula and write down the actual probability distribution. We know what the mass is. Okay. We don't know what alpha is, and I'm going to write down the probability distribution essentially treating alpha as if it was constant, and we'll see later how that's okay. We know what the prior distribution is for lambda, and I'm going to put that in. We also think we know roughly what the distribution is over the TC, but again, it would be clearer to do the analysis by first treating this as constant. Okay, so I'm going to treat G and alpha as constant, and I'm going to draw a picture. So I'm doing this again at fixed T observer. Let me draw a graph for this. So I'm going to put log Tc on this axis and log T lambda on this one. And I have to mark the special place that corresponds to T observer. Okay. So I'll write down some formulas. So now there are many different special cases. You've already seen here that there are basically three cases corresponding to a universe where there is a period of curvature domination. And then there are two more cases that I haven't talked about which corresponds to a universe where there is never a period of curvature domination. In other words, the one where Tc is greater than T lambda. Okay, so let's write them all down. And here's the probability distribution, again, with alpha and g suppressed. Didn't put them in. Alpha is the number of observers per unit mass. G is the probability distribution over the number of e-foldings of inflation. I'm suppressing those right now. So the last two are the cases where the universe is never curvature dominated. Okay, and instead of writing down the actual inequalities that are satisfied by these five cases, let me just number them and show you where they are in this graph. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. Okay. So let me draw a diagonal. The diagonal separates the case where there is a period of curvature domination, which is where T curvature is large enough. Sorry, it's actually this one. And from the cases where, where Tc is small enough. So this this triangle corresponds to these three cases where Tc is less than T lambda, and this one corresponds to the case where the universe is always flat. Tc is greater than T lambda. And then to further take into account how T observer relates to the other quantities, let me draw two more lines here. And now I can put in my Roman numbers. Okay. So now, what I could do here is offer you a three-dimensional plot of this probability distribution over these two variables. But really, what's happening, right, is that we're interested in log Tc and log T lambda. And so from the point of view of the variables we're trying to determine, these are all exponentially strong distributions. Okay. And so we just need to know where they peak. That's where almost all the probability is going to be. Okay. They're at least exponentially strong. Here they're sort of doubly exponentially strong in log T lambda. So let's just draw this. So for example, in region one, this is telling us that Tc wants to be small. Okay, so I'm going to put an arrow like this. Region 2, Tc wants to be large, so let's put an arrow like that. Region 3, if you stare at it long enough, you realize that Tc and T lambda both want to be large in region 3. And region 4, T lambda wants to be large. Tc doesn't matter. Region 5, T lambda wants to be small. Tc doesn't matter. Tc had better not matter here. This is the place where there's never any curvature domination. So that's what it looks like. Again, I have left out the number of observers per unit mass. I've left out the prior for the number of e-foldings. So this is sort of the zeroth order result. And what you see here is that if you follow the arrows to the place of maximum probability, is that it's actually two degenerate half lines on which these are sort of ridges on which the probability is constant. So we haven't yet really determined these parameters. And so now it's nice to see how something like G can come in to lift this degeneracy. Okay, so here, so far, I've pretended that an extra e-folding of inflation doesn't cost me anything. But actually, we don't think so. We think that there's a little bit of additional pressure that comes from the prior that is going to tilt these arrows a little bit towards smaller TC, and so it's going to lift this degeneracy and push you here.
Okay.
But it's not so clear what happens with this half line. So maybe now is a good time to think about the role of alpha, the number of observers per unit mass. And this is sort of a central argument that I hope I'll be able to explain well. Notice that region 4, region 5, this one here, is extremely strongly suppressed. Okay, I need to put this line back in. It's doubly exponentially suppressed as I increase the cosmological constant. I really get penalized for it. Okay, I really don't want to be there. So I think I mislabeled these probably. Hang on. Yeah. Okay, this is 4. 4 down here corresponds to small t lambda, that's large cosmological constant, that's extremely strongly suppressed. Okay, doubly exponentially in log t lambda. Okay. So this arrow is a really thick arrow pushing you up here. Okay, this arrow pushing you down here is just the usual cosmological constant problem. Lambda wants to be large. But what's happening down here is, well, if lambda is so large that it starts dominating, say, at this time, before the observers form, let's say 10 times earlier, well, then you've got several e-foldings of de Sitter expansion before the observers form, independently of whether there's any galaxy formation disrupted and all that sort of detailed anthropic stuff. There simply won't be very much mass in here. So even if we assume that no other bad things happen, there's nothing left, or exponentially little left, inside the causal patch that we get to count at the time t observer if t lambda is earlier than that. Okay, so that's what I mean by a geometric effect. That's the dominant effect. Okay, that if I draw a probability distribution corresponding to this particular section through this graph, so if I put log lambda here, well, there's a rise. I want to have large cosmological constant because there are more vacua like that. And then there's an incredibly steep cutoff that comes from this effect. Now, maybe in detailed models, I would also take into account galaxy disruption and so on, but that would just make this cliff a little bit steeper further down the line. It will not change the fact that probability is already completely suppressed in this region. Now, but this is the region, right, where alpha is what I don't know how to compute without very detailed information about what observers require to live and what the detailed cosmological dynamics is going to do to galaxies or whatever else I care about. It doesn't matter, right? That's in this part of the plot, it doesn't matter what alpha is. Okay. On the other hand, in this part of the plot, which comes from the prior, I'm in a regime where the timescale of the cosmological constant is larger than T observer. And so the number of observers per unit mass cannot possibly depend on the cosmological constant in this regime because the cosmological constant hasn't had a chance to show any dynamical effect whatsoever by the time that the observers open their eyes. Okay. So therefore, in region 5, alpha is constant. It is not a function of T lambda. Okay, as long as T lambda is greater than T observer, alpha can't depend on it. So I essentially know everything I need to know about this distribution. Okay, in particular, I know that alpha is not going to lift the degeneracy along this half line. Okay, so this half line is solid. Okay, the other thing that, and so there's now a completely analogous argument that I can make about the time scale of curvature domination. Yes. Yeah.
The universe is 10 to 10 years old now.
Yeah.
Stars are going to keep shining until they're 10 to 14.
Okay.
So if I just naively
Yeah. We could of course play the game the other way around, where we start by specifying something like T lambda and letting T observer scan. One thing that may be relevant to your comment is you may be worried that, you know, there's something wrong the way things work in our universe because the stars are going to shine so much longer. Why do we live so early? But in terms of things that I think actually matter that we can quantify, such as entropy production, most of it happens actually a little bit earlier than now. The peak of entropy production was like at 3 giga years or something like that. So it's true that a couple of dim stars are going to fizzle away, but it's not. Well, you want to talk about stars? I'll talk about stars. All I'm saying is that in terms of the actual action you get from these stars, most of it has already happened. It's true that there will be some, you know, dim candles burning along for a long time. But yes. But I didn't completely understand how your question pertains to this analysis where we don't even talk about stars and galaxies and so on. So I thought I would. Let's postpone it to the discussion because I need to finish up. So there's an analogous argument that you can make about curvature domination. Again, if curvature dominates later than T observer, then the number of observers per unit mass can't depend on T curvature in that regime. Curvature hasn't had any chance to have an effect on the formation of observers. And in the regime where curvature can have an effect, the probability distribution is very suppressed. So good. So this is nice. We know that alpha isn't going to change our conclusions, but our conclusions so far don't make us too happy. Okay? It looks like we have a degenerate half-line of possible values of T lambda, and therefore of the cosmological constant. We are predicting that curvature should not dominate too long after T observer. It's not a prediction, by the way, that these are exactly equal because this distribution is so weak. That's basically the calculation that Matt and Ben mentioned. But we don't have a clear prediction for T lambda, and in fact, it looks like maybe we have a wrong prediction for T lambda. This half-line isn't going to continue on forever. Okay, so first of all, we have to make sure we don't get a divergence here or a non-normalizability of the distribution. It's not going to continue on forever because actually the number of vacua in the landscape is finite, and the smallest cosmological constant that you can find is presumably of order 1 over the number of vacua if they're randomly distributed. And so there is going to be such a thing as log T lambda max, the latest time when the cosmological constant can dominate in a metastable de Sitter vacuum, just because there's a finite number of such vacua. That's fine. Okay, so now we have a normalizable probability distribution. But we would basically predict that T lambda should be drawn at random from this interval between log T observer and log T max, T lambda max. And so, you know, there's no reason why lambda shouldn't be much, much smaller than the value that we've observed. Why T lambda shouldn't be much, much larger than now, T observer, okay? Unless, so this brings us to the final step, there's some reason why T observer runs up against T lambda max. And this interval shrinks down to zero once I let T observer scan. So now we have to do that part. But in order to simplify matters, let me now integrate everything else out and just ask about the probability distribution as a function of T observer. And so let's write that down. So you get a log just from the fact that So T lambda max is completely fixed. That's determined by the number of vacua in the theory. Okay, and the length of this interval is greater if T observer is smaller. That's what gives you this log. And the T observer to the minus one corresponds to just plugging in the correct values of TC and T lambda into these formulas. That's the actual probability density at these values. Well, but this is not all. Okay. So now I have to, again, take into account that the number of observers per unit mass averaged over all vacua that lie in this range, which I'm now considering, will in itself depend on when those observers live. Okay. And there's another factor which I could have unified with this one, but let's keep it separate. Which is the fraction of these vacua that have observers at the time T observer. Right, so I need observers to be there. I need to ask how many there are per unit mass, and that multiplies this probability that I've computed. Not anymore, because I've integrated out TC, so I've already been pushed to here. There are a couple of sub-leading logs that you can find in the paper, which contain further factors that aren't going to be important. Now, I can make an assumption, okay? And this is an assumption, but it's not an assumption like observers require galaxies or lambda disrupts galaxies or things like that. It's a very simple statement about how these numbers, how this function behaves. There's essentially two simple things that this product can do. It can grow with the observer, or it can shrink with the observer. Let's think of it as a power law. It doesn't have to be an exact power law. But what I need it to do is, over a sufficiently large range, I need this product to grow more strongly than linearly with T observer. And that is an assumption, again. But it's essentially, it's a kind of 50-50 type assumption. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't. There are some arguments that one can give for why this product should grow with T observer. What's hard to show is that it should grow at least as strong as that. It's possible, maybe it doesn't. If I understood the landscape better, I would give you the answer. The reason that it's plausible that it should grow with T observer is simply that, well, the number of observers per unit mass should grow with, again, averaged over many vacua, should grow with the time scale when you're trying to make those observers, because at later times, the universe is bigger, the density is lower, you get to divide up the mass that you have into more and more quanta without them overlapping. So on general grounds, you can have more complexity out of the same amount of mass if you wait longer. The fraction of vacua that have observers at T observer should also grow with T observer, simply because it seems like, it takes a long time for evolution or whatever the processes are to grow to that level of complexity that the observers are there. It's good to have more time. Then you can try longer. So again, I'm not trying to tell you that I have a sharp argument that this has to be correct, but that, it's not a crazy assumption to make. And that's the assumption that's being put in here. And of course, once you put that in, then the overall probability distribution is basically going to go like T observer to some positive power times some log that we don't care about, and we find the advertised result. In other words, T observer is going to run up to the latest time scale that it can be while still sitting on this crest. Okay, and that's T lambda max. That's the prediction. And that prediction can now be combined with the other predictions that we already had for this general case where we were holding T observer fixed to some particular value. We found that TC gets pegged to T observer. So T lambda max is of order number of vacua to the minus a half power, because T lambda is lambda to the, to the plus a half power. T lambda is lambda to the minus a half. And Tc gets pegged to that by the arguments given earlier. And, I guess I should make two more comments. One is that this raises a different question. Okay, so what the causal patch measure solves primarily is actually the coincidence problem. Okay, it tells you that that T lambda and T observer should be correlated to each other. If we now go to more specialized vacua, say vacua like ours that have galaxies potentially in them, you could ask, why is T galaxy so close to us? I mean, Weinberg's argument played no role here anymore. So you have to. I think the way to think of that is different. And there's some papers with Lawrence Hall and Yasunori Nomura where we discuss this. It probably is hard to make galaxies. It takes a long time. T galaxy wants to be late, and it bumps up against these other scales. And there are arguments like that you can make for several of these giga-year timescales that we see in our universe. Why do they coincide? They all bump up against this limit. And the final remark I want to make is that this does not work very well for a negative cosmological constant. All these miracles don't happen where you get pushed into a regime where basically your probability distribution doesn't depend on alpha. It depends very strongly on how many observers form. With the most straightforward interpretation or assumptions about alpha, you find that the measure actually favors being in a negative lambda vacuum over a positive lambda vacuum. This is not a completely new result. Hints of that were found a few years ago already by Mike Salem. I suspect that, I'm pretty sure that if this measure is right, it's at best an approximation to the right answer. And I suspect that this approximation is not very good for negative cosmological constant. One could speculate about why that is the case, but you're talking about regions that are in the vicinity of a space-like singularity. Understanding cosmology in such regions is not something that I think we do very well from any fundamental perspective, and so perhaps it's not surprising that when we put two huge problems together, we really fall on our nose. But I think that's one of the important open problems. Is there some way of understanding, of finding at least an approximate solution to the measure problem for negative cosmological constant? We found that it doesn't help to go over to other generally viable measures in the positive cosmological constant case, such as the scale factor measure. I don't think there's any really good measure right now for negative cosmological constant vacuum. Thank you.
Questions for Raphael? Don?
You know, I think that's very interesting that you could get, you know, some scales, even a log scale for, you know, the size of the universe, and of course that would also. Oops. Oh, right. Darn, I did this in church a few weeks ago. Talk. They thought I was a clued-out physicist, but anyway.
It's okay. We would hear you without a microphone.
Okay, that's true. Okay. So anyway, that's extremely interesting that you could get some idea as to what sets the overall size of the universe, and of course that eventually could trickle down into our size and complexity, because I've long wondered, you know, if the landscape is very, very big and there's arbitrarily more complex things, why don't we perceive ourselves to be, you know, infinitely complex? I just wish to note, I spent a marathon session of 17 hours in the building here on Sunday, finally writing up a paper, knowing that you were coming, on using your results with Hall and Nomura, where you had the age of the, you know, all these time scales gave us, I forget, alpha squared over m electron mass squared and m proton mass or something like that, which you can combine. There were some older arguments that Brandon Carter gave for relating the fine structure constant to the mass of the proton, electron, and Bernard Carr and Martin Rees farmed that up. So and they gave arguments involving stars and nucleosynthesis and so on that in Planck units the mass of the electrons roughly the 12th power of alpha and the mass of the protons the 10th power, And then a few years ago, I combined that with renormalization group arguments to get a log relation between the two. So you could pin down, and if you threw out all the fudge factors, including a factor 10 that Karin Rees put in, so if you throw that out just to simplify it, you get a prediction of alpha of being 1 over 162. So the charge of the electron you can predict to be within 8% of its observed values without inputting any observed continuous parameter. You do have to put in, like, the number of Higgs, doublets, blah, 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 the dimensions of space and so on. But if you combine it with your argument, you get the interesting thing that with your numbers with Hall and so on, you could get the cosmological constant to be the 128th power of the charge of the electron in Planck units. And if you use this funny, these particular numbers that I got by solving for that, you get instead of 10 to the minus 121, you get 10 to the minus 141.
Okay, Don, I'm going to let the rest of this be your talk. I think it's a very interesting set of arguments. I want to make one distinction clear, which is that already at the starting point of what you do there, you've basically limited yourself to vacua which have the basic low energy structure that ours has, and which have observers that require the sort of things that we require. So my concern is that if you let enough things scan, that once again there will be, there'll be runaway directions, there'll be things that you won't be able to fix. You could put all sorts of physics between the gut scale and what we know that would alter these conclusions, even within the context of these very particular vacua and very particular observers. But I think that doesn't change the fact that, you can ask these kind of questions. It's nice to get the right answer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely using one.
Doesn't the prediction that the cosmological constant is the smallest allowed in the landscape contradict the estimates of the number of landscape vacuum?
Yeah, good. So, in fact, I forgot to come back to that, so I'm really glad you asked. This curly N isn't really the number of vacua in the landscape. Okay, there are various suppression factors that come in. One is cosmological production of vacua. Yisheng and I studied this several years ago. If you start out with some toy BP-type landscape with 10 to the 300 vacua, say, and you start out with initial vacua at the Planck scale, there are certain fluxes that like to decay faster than others, and you actually only populate some fraction of this landscape that can easily suppress the effective size of the landscape by 10 to the hundredth. To start with, of course, at best our uncertainty here is that, we don't really know that there are 10 to the 500 vacua, right? Maybe there are 10 to the 200 or 10 to the 800. So I'm not claiming that there's a prediction that exactly matches the string theory calculation here. All I'm saying is that this is a glimpse, perhaps, of how it might work. There are additional suppression factors come from the fact that, even if you look at the cosmologically produced vacua, you look at the one with the smallest cosmological constant, it almost certainly won't have any observers in it. There are all the extra stuff that has to happen for complexity to be there. And again, I have no idea how to estimate that suppression factor, but I imagine it could be quite large. So again, it's not like I'm making a quantitative prediction saying, it matches. It's more like that last part here is really just an idea of where the origin of these crazy hierarchies might lie.
Thank you.